Many of you here this evening, and you're all very welcome. I hope you've had you've enjoyed your curry and had a chance to get to know each other and to maybe meet some people you haven't met before. My name is Nigel Taylor. I'm a member of the church family here at St. John's, and it's now time to meet our guest for the evening, retired Major General Tim Cross, CBE. I'd like to welcome him up, and everybody, if you'd like to welcome him.
Thank you very much. I think I'll leave now. That was a great report.
General Till, welcome, and thank you very much for giving up your Friday evening to spend time with us.
Spending a traffic jam getting here, but no, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Great. Well, to start, rather than me introduce you and summarise your career, it'd probably be more helpful for everyone to hear it directly from you yourself. So, could you please just summarise for us in a few minutes your military career and the various operations that you you took part in?
Sure. We've got a slide, actually. I don't know whether that's going to be able to go up there, but that's quite useful because I can see it from here too, so I can remember what I did. I always wanted to be in the military. I wasn't very clever academically. In fact, if you put the next slide up, what's the next slide say? Yeah, there we go. My favourite quote, really, is by H.G. Wells. And I have to say, he's reputed to have said, I don't know this for a fact, but he's reputed to have said that the professional military mind is by necessity an inferior and unimaginative mind. No man of high intellectual ability would willingly imprison his gifts in such a calling. So that's me, and I just want to manage your expectations. I have to say it's Nigel too, and one or two other people here this evening who've got military connections. But I'd always wanted to join the military because I genuinely wasn't very clever at school. I left school with virtually no qualifications at all. And actually, in today's world, I'm not sure I'd get in the army because it's all done online now, and you have to tick boxes and all that sort of stuff. But I became a cadet in 1964, barely 20 years after D-Day, in a nation that understood the military. Just about everybody had friends, fathers, sons, relatives and so forth serving in World War II. And so things like Remembrance Day, which of course we're coming up to at the end of next week, were, you know, big personal affairs, family affairs. People had serious memories of people who'd fought, and indeed had fought in the First World War. So it was a great grounding for me. I then managed to get into an Army sixth form college for a couple of years, and then went to Sandhurst in 1969 and was commissioned in 1971. And the troubles in Northern Ireland, which Nigel knows about better than I do, really, but were kicking off 68, 69, 1970. And for just about everybody in the British Army in those days, that we did a tour. I did a tour in Northern Ireland. So I came out of Sandhurst in 71, actually did a tour in Germany to begin with, and then did an in-service degree. Simon was chatting about this earlier on, about the system paid for me to get my degree. I really feel for the youngsters today who end up with deep debt when they have to, you know, borrow money and so forth. But I did my in-service degree, and then I did a tour in Northern Ireland, bomb disposal work, based near Belfast, travelling all over the province doing that stuff, plus other ammunition stuff and so on. And for the first time, really, began to see the reality behind the headlines, the brutal kneecappings, the murders, and so forth, and began to ask myself, you know, some pretty serious questions about what was going on here. Why do people do this to each other, particularly in a country where supposedly everybody was Christian? So the 70s were dominated, really, by Northern Ireland, and the 70s and 80s dominated by the Cold War. Many of you looking around the room were certainly alive, but some not. Cold War was going on until the late 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. I did three other tours in Germany as an adjutant, a company commander, and a battalion commander as part of NATO, part of what was called the Northern Army Group, based in the north of Germany. There was a Central Army Group further south, two big Allied tactical air forces. We had something like 50,000 main battle tanks in Germany in those days. Several thousand combat aircraft. The Warsaw Pact had even more than that. Just about every town in northern Germany had a British garrison of some sort. And we had a corps of three divisions based in Germany with another division back here in the UK. Around 60,000, 65,000 soldiers permanently living in Germany with wives, with families, making up a community of well over 100,000. British schools, hospitals, It was an extraordinary situation, really, looking back on it. But it was all part of the deterrent posture against the Warsaw Pact, and we might come back to that in the context of Russia and Ukraine a little bit later. But that all comes to an end at the end of the 1980s. And I remember as the Cold War came to an end, literally sitting in the officers' mess talking to fellow officers at the time, thinking, what are we going to do with each other now? You know, the threat's gone. Immediately, of course, Iraq invaded Kuwait, and then the Balkans exploded with Tito dying, and the Balkans wars kicked off in the early part of the 90s. So I was part of 1st Armored Division that went off to the Gulf in the first Gulf campaign, and then did three tours in the Balkans, not in the initial peace, which was a UN peacekeeping operation, but there was no peace to keep, and in the end, an agreement was signed at a place called Dayton, and the NATO went in, and I was part of that implementation force, and then a sustainment force, and then later on went back as part of the Kosovo force called KFOR. So it was a pretty busy decade. And then as we turned into the new millennium, obviously September the 11th happened, and then 2003 I ended up in Baghdad as a major general, working in initially Washington and then Kuwait and then Baghdad. And I know we're going to come back to that a bit later, because for the first time in my life I lived through failure, big style strategic failure. The rest of it had been, you know, fairly successful. So I was very lucky, and in between all of those tours, those operational tours, I attended staff college did various other staff tours here in the UK, and I left in 2007. And it sounds a bit pathetic, really, but I loved every day of it. The soldiers were fantastic. The places I served in, great privilege to serve in. And the operational tours, demanding, of course, but nonetheless, you know, very fulfilling. And when I left, I didn't want to work for a big organization, so I decided to set up a limited company. And I now run a portfolio, which is with business. I'm on the board of some companies. I'm a visiting professor at some universities and do quite a lot of speaking. And I'm a lay minister in the Church of England. Which we'll, again, we'll come back to in a bit. So I hope that makes sense. Have I covered everything? I think so, probably.
Yes, indeed. That's everything. So, General Tim, you have, as you described, you have first-hand experience of the realities of war and conflict, and you're a Christian. So what would you say to someone who asked you why a loving and all-powerful God would allow wars to happen?
Yeah. Well, as I said earlier, that, you know, when you, I mean, I've watched the mass graves being dug up in Iraq. I've seen some pretty awful things over the years. And it's often a surprise to people how many Christians there are in the military, not just the army, but in the military as a whole. And it's because people ask themselves some pretty sensible questions. Why do people do this? What is going on here? Why does God allow this? And, you know, it's an issue, it's a serious issue, and everybody has to think their way through that. For me, having become a Christian in 1981, and then studied and thought, you know, I suppose much deeper about some of these issues. The simple answer for me is, you go back to the story of the Garden of Eden. I mean, I know many of you here aren't Christians tonight, so I don't know whether you know the scriptures, but I think most people have heard of Genesis and the story of the Garden of Eden. When Adam and Eve are in the garden, and God says, you can do basically whatever you like here, eat whatever you like, go wherever you like, do your own thing, but there's only two things you can't do, and that's eat the fruit from a couple of these trees. And the bottom line is, Adam and Eve, we the blokes like to say it was Eve first, say, actually, don't tell me what to do. I'll be my own God, thank you very much. I'll decide what I'm going to do with my life. And they eat the fruit, and God kicks them out of the garden. Now, however you see that story, to me, that sums up the reality that we live, first of all, in a fallen world, a broken world. I mean, in Christian terms, it's a fallen world because we rejected God's plan in the Garden of Eden, if you like. It's a broken world which results in the things that I've seen and the things that you see in the headlines and every day. And I'm sure many of you have come across all sorts of aspects of the nature of that world. I was in Pentonville Prison earlier this week. I go into prisons occasionally and speak. And, you know, the criminality and the brutality and the shootings and the killings and the drugs. My youngest son works for the National Crime Agency. And all of that is part of the broken world that we live in. And it's not God that causes these wars. It's us. And I am part of that problem, and you are part of that problem too. Because in the grand scheme of things, we can talk about the big wars and, that go on, but at the end of the day, lust and adultery and you know, all the other things that go on in our relationships are part of the problem. So I don't blame God for what's going on in the world. What I would also add is that, in my view, part of the vision, the mission, if you like, of Jesus is that he gets in the blood and the guts and the awfulness of the world and joins us in it and then sacrifices himself for us. And we'll probably come back to that. But so it's not as though God sort of stands back and rubs his hand together with glee and says, let him get on with it. He actually comes down and intervenes and involves himself in the reality of it in an attempt to reconcile us back to himself, back into the relationship that Adam and Eve had in the garden. If you read the story of the garden, Adam and Eve talked to God. They walked in the gardens and talked to him and knew his presence. And that's what we need to get back to.
So, General Zimmer, you mentioned that you became a Christian in 1981.
Yeah.
How did that happen? How did you become a Christian?
Well, like I suspect like many of you here, even though you might not call yourself Christians, I was raised in a middle-class home. My father worked for Shell, traveled over the world. We lived in Australia and so forth for a while. But I was adopted by him, and my mother married him when I was tiny as a baby. But we, you know, I would have considered myself to be a Christian. We didn't go to church, but I was baptized in a church. And we went to churches for weddings and baptisms and funerals and all that sort of stuff. And when I got married in 1972, Christine and I were married in church. We had children very quickly, and they were baptized and so on. And I would have called myself a Christian and was very happy going to church. But the reality was that Jesus Christ, in inverted commas, meant nothing to me, really. I understood some of the scriptures and so on. But I went to serve in Cyprus, did a peacekeeping tour in Cyprus. Cyprus, a divided nation, another one of these divided nations between Greek and Turk. The Turks had invaded Cyprus in 74, and it was sort of there was a green line through the middle of the country through Nicosia, and I served in Nicosia as part of the UN force. To be honest, it wasn't a very demanding tour, but I managed to get a break over the Easter, 1981, on a UN plane. Christine and I left the children with some friends. We flew to Jerusalem. We had 4 days. It was the Easter weekend, and we just went as tourists, really. Easter Day, we went to the Anglican Cathedral to attend the Easter Sunday service, which was, you know, a nice service. We'd been to Bethlehem and one or two other tourist places. But over a cup of coffee, somebody said to me, have you been to the Garden Tomb? I don't know if anybody's heard of the Garden Tomb. I'd certainly never heard of it. But to cut a long story short, the Garden Tomb is a garden outside of the old city wall. It's got a first century wine press, it's got a first century tomb, it's got a hill that looks like a skull. The classic tourist place for the death and crucifixion of Christ is in a church called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is inside the old city walls, and it's where most people go. But this place outside of the city walls had been actually discovered some time ago, and General Gordon, who died at Khartoum, had been part of excavating this place. And a lot of people began to think that this was more likely to be the place that Christ had died and had been crucified. So he explained that to me, and Christine and I decided we would go. I was a captain. It was Easter Sunday. It was my 30th birthday that day. And the guide in the Garden Tomb was an army colonel, British army colonel, called Dobby, which was a pretty extraordinary God incidence, to coin a phrase. So he took us around, showed us around, and then sat both of us down. We looked in St. John's Gospel. He explained why this matched up with what John's Gospel had to say about the crucifixion and so on. And then he said, look, this may or may not be the place. That's, you know, it's important for me because he said, I happen to believe it is the place. It's why I'm here. But it may or may not be the place. But the important thing is, if you go and look in the tomb is empty. I'm feeling a bit of a plank. I stood up, walked over to this rock, and looked inside this tomb. And I'm not quite sure to this day what I expected to find. But anyway, it was empty. But as I leant on the entrance to this tomb, I found myself asking, for the first time in my life, what I think is a pretty serious question. And I think it's a question we all have to ask and try and answer. If the tomb was not empty on that first Easter Sunday, then millions, tens of hundreds of millions of people for 2,000 years have been wasting their time. I'm wasting my time now. You're wasting your time being here. Christianity is built on a complete falsehood. If Christ did not rise from the dead, then, as Paul says in one of his letters, we are amongst all people to be pitied. On the other hand, if he did rise from the dead, then everything changes. Now, it wasn't quite a Damascus Road experience for me. It was, you know, a pretty hard-hitting moment, and I went back to Cyprus. And over the next 2 or 3 months, I found myself thinking about this more and more. I looked in the scriptures. I did various things. And in the end, and the reason I like doing men's events and I like doing men's breakfasts and so forth is we blokes need to make decisions. Too many of us sit on the fence, and we're not prepared to get off the fence. And I found myself saying, I can't sit on this fence any longer. I'm going to have to make a decision. Either he did not rise from the dead, and therefore let's not waste my time and get on the rest of my career and the rest of my life. Or if he did, then something has to change. And I made the decision. I didn't understand it all. I just made the decision that I wanted to be a disciple of Christ. And I made that decision. And everything changed. And it's been the best decision I ever made in my life. And I would ask and challenge you, all of you, particularly those of you who are not Christians, to ask yourself that sort of question. You know, why are you here tonight? What's going on? So it was a really important time for me, and it transformed my life.
So when you did become a Christian, did it make you question whether or not you should leave the army?
Yeah. I mean, yes, because as you can imagine, most people would say, you can't be a Christian in the military. Now, there's a whole raft of debate here, and I do a separate talk on that in all sorts of places. But it was an issue, and I found myself thinking, well, maybe I need to leave. Actually, Paul says in one of his letters, the first letter to the church in Corinth, essentially, whatever you're doing when you become a Christian, just stay there unless you're being called out to go and do something else. I didn't realize that at the time. I now realize that now, later. But at the time, I looked at the scriptures and I tried to work my way through that process. I talked to a good friend of mine who was a Christian, and I chatted to other people and so on. And there's lots of biblical stuff that I found quite helpful. When John the Baptist was baptizing people in the River Jordan, a whole raft of different people go to see him to be baptized, including a bunch of soldiers. And the soldiers say to John the Baptist, "What must we do to be saved?" And I always think rather sadly, he tells them to be content with their pay. he doesn't tell them to leave the military. What he's actually saying, I think, is don't abuse your power. Because soldiers in those days, in order to, you know, get a decent living, would abuse their power. They would force people to do things and protection rackets and all sorts of other stuff. So John the Baptist doesn't tell them to leave. He tells them to not abuse their power. Jesus meets a centurion whose servant is very ill. And the centurion says, "Would you please come and heal him, or would you please heal my servant?" And Jesus makes to go with him. And the centurion's a Roman commander of 100 soldiers. The centurion says, "You don't need to come anywhere. I'm a centurion. I'm a soldier. I tell people what to do, and they do it. I say, come here, and they come. I say, go there, and they go." He said, "All you need to do is give the word of command, and my servant will be healed." And Jesus looks around and says, "I've never met faith anywhere like this in Israel." Now, if it was fundamentally wrong to be a Christian or be a soldier, then I can't believe that Jesus would have said something like that. And the servant is healed at that moment. Later on in the book of Acts, Peter, one of the apostles, gets a vision. He goes to see another Roman centurion called Cornelius. Cornelius and his family become the first non-Jewish family to be baptized into the Christian faith. Again, if there was something fundamentally wrong with being a soldier, would God use Peter to go a long way to meet this family and baptize them? Paul uses a lot of soldierly language in the letters. So in studying all of this, I found myself thinking, I need to stay, and the issue is, how am I going to then stay and be a better Christian? And the last thing I'd just add to that is, a lot of people would say, well, Jesus was a pacifist. I don't think that's true. Early on in Luke's gospel, he sends his disciples out And he says to them, don't take a staff or any money or spare sandals or anything else. Just get out there and heal the sick and preach the gospel, basically. And that's true. But later on, the night before he is crucified, in the upper room, the Last Supper, Jesus then reverses those instructions. And he says, amongst other things, he says, and if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. And one of the disciples says, we've got two swords here in the room. And Jesus says, that's enough. Now, if he was a pacifist and there was something fundamentally wrong with force, in inverted commas, what are they doing with two swords in the upper room the night before the crucifixion? And what are they doing with carrying them into the Garden of Gethsemane? Now, I don't believe it's the right time to use force, but I don't think that it tells me that Jesus wasn't a pacifist. The issue is, how do you use that force to be a force for good in the world? And so I decided to stay and work my way through that.
And so, having decided to stay and being a Christian, what difference did that make during the rest of your career?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is, and this isn't, you know, this is in one sense easy to say, but it's not easy to live and it's not easy to acknowledge. But I'll use a story from the Old Testament, which is a story I found myself probably 30 years ago really pondering over. Many of you, again, certainly those of you who are Christian, will have heard of Joshua. Joshua was Moses' ADC when the Israeli people came out of slavery in Egypt. And he takes over from Moses to lead the Israeli people, the Jewish people, into the Promised Land. And the first battle that he's going to fight in a campaign to secure the Promised Land is the Battle of Jericho. And in Joshua, the book of Joshua, in about chapter 5, chapter 6, there's a little snippet of about six or eight verses of Joshua on his own prior to the Battle of Jericho. And I have to say I can absolutely relate to this. Prior to some of the campaigns and some of the operations that I was on, particularly as a battalion brigade and commander, you go off on your own and you ask yourself some pretty sensible questions. Are we going to win? Am I going to die? Will I be courageous? How's this all going to turn out? So in my mind, I have a picture of Joshua on his own prior to this battle asking those sorts of questions. And the story says that Joshua meets a man dressed in armor. And he asks the man a very sensible question. Are you on our side or are you on their side? And the bloke looks at him and says, neither. No, depending on the translation, which isn't a very helpful answer, really. But Joshua responds in the story by taking off his shoes, falling on his face, and saying, what are my Lord's commands? Because this man, having said no, says, but as the commander of the Lord's army, I have now come. Now, if I'd been the brigade commander at the time, the equivalent of Joshua, I think I would have been inclined to call the sergeant major and arrest this bloke and throw him in the nick and say, come on, we need to get on with this campaign. But Joshua doesn't do that. He says, what are my Lord's commands? And he's then given, for those of you who know the story, the most ridiculous battle plan that anybody could possibly come up with. He's told to march around the city of Jericho 7 times, blow some trumpets, and the walls will come down and it'll be fine. And Joshua must have thought, this is crazy. You know, we're never going to win the battle now. So he has a decision to make. Does he do what he's been told to do, or does he plow his own furrow, in inverted commas? Does he produce his own campaign plan? Of course, he does what he's told to do. And for those of us who remember going to Sunday school, we used to sing the old song, and the walls come tumbling down. Now, for me, the message of that story is, who's in command? And having become a Christian, having to recognize that I was no longer in command of my own life. God was in command. There was my commission is to the Queen and now the King, of course. But ultimately, I had a new commander-in-chief. And that meant that when I was at Sandhurst, for example, the hat badge that we had wore on our hats for the 2 years at Sandhurst, the hat badge said, serve to lead. It's a great, great message. That leadership is all about servant. And Christ is the classic example of that. In Philippians, he's talked about as being the servant king. So words like service, words like integrity and courage and honor and duty and selfless service and so forth, suddenly began to take a new meaning. And for me, this didn't happen overnight, it happened over a period of time, but it just meant I needed to recognize that that I was under command and that I needed to lead better, differently. It was no longer about me and my needs and my ambitions and so forth. It was about the people I had the privilege to serve and the privilege to lead, and to try to do that better. And of course, I failed regularly, but ultimately, that was the big difference. And it did make a difference for me, because until that point, basically my life was my life. Going back to the Garden of Eden, I was in command, thank you very much. I'll decide what to do with my life. I'll decide what my career is going to look like. And that had to change. And it wasn't easy, but it did.
What difference did it make when you were in Kosovo and dealing with the situation there?
Yes, there are several times in all of our lives, I think, when we face, quite difficult decisions. But I don't think they happen all that often. But having become a Christian at 30, I then served in these various places. But Kosovo was quite an interesting deployment. Again, I think we've got some slides. Again, going back to the early period of the 1990s, Yugoslavia breaks apart, the Balkans wars happen. And then in 1999, Serbia starts to give the Kosovo Albanians a hard time. There was a thing called the Kosovo Liberation Army. They were fighting for independence from Serbia. And Milosevic and the Serbs began to conduct ethnic cleansing. And when I say conduct ethnic cleansing, this had gone on in the Balkans previously, of course, but if you can imagine, you're living somewhere in Pristina, for example, which was the capital of Kosovo, a knock would come on the door at 10 o'clock at night, and you'd be told, if you'd not gone by the morning, we're going to kill you and kill your family. So people were leaving their homes and heading for the hills. The men heading for the hills, literally, in order to join the Kosovo Liberation Army and to fight. And the women, the wives, the children, just heading off into the country, just getting out of the towns and cities. So they came. There's some pictures that were taken at the time. And the next one was, I think, they came on. And actually, all the refugee crisis in Europe over the last few years, and watching even the boat, the asylum seekers and all the rest of it, we'll all have views about what's going on, but it does bring back memories of seeing tens of thousands of people on the move. And they arrive in various ways, as you see on the pictures. Again, the next one, we've got the young, the old. Most of the men were away, as I say, so most of these guys were the families and the old people and so on. And they were kicking out of Kosovo, and a lot of them went into Albania, but a lot were trying to get into Macedonia, and the Macedonian government wouldn't let them in. So they arrived at the border, which I think is the next slide, to chaos. And I was a brigade commander at the time. Tony Blair had decided to deploy two brigades to Kosovo, or to Macedonia, via Greece, in anticipation that there would be some sort of agreement, as there had been at Dayton back in 1995, and that Milosevic would basically sign some sort of deal, and we would go into Kosovo and conduct some sort of peace support or peace enforcement operation. And that conference was going on at a place called Rambouillet. So Tony Blair had deployed the brigades, and I was one of them. The other one was 4 Armoured Brigade, and we were at that time around Skopje, the capital of Macedonia, waiting to go into Kosovo when all of this started happening. And so from going back to the story in inverted commas from a Christian perspective, somehow a guy called Joe Hegenar, who worked for the UN High Commission for Refugees in Kosovo with a small team of about a dozen blokes, found me, and he was a classic humanitarian. He told me afterwards, I hated talking to a soldier and asking for help, because as far as he was concerned, the military were the cause of most of these sort of problems. But he basically said to me, I need help. I've got a very small team. There are no other aid agencies, no other UN organizations. And I think we're going to be in a serious problem here. And he took me to the border. And on the other side of the border, if you just go back one, actually, on the other side of the border, that's inside Kosovo. And I was looking at this from the Macedonian side. That was what was going on. Tens of thousands of people, many living in open fields, poor weather, people dying. No food, no shelter, and so on. And I went back to my brigade headquarters and I said to my chief of staff, we're going to find ourselves getting embroiled in this somehow. I don't quite know how it's going to pan out, but I suspect we're going to be involved in this. And then about 3 days later, again, going back to my comment about the Garden Tomb, God incident. I mean, General Mike Jackson, who some of you may have heard of, was commanding K4. There were lots of other senior officers around, more senior than me. My mobile phone rang, and the Macedonian Foreign Secretary introduced himself to me over the phone and said, if I let these people in, can you guarantee to me that they will not end up in Skopje, the capital, or anywhere else in Macedonia? How he got my number, I haven't got a clue. And I genuinely believe that this was a God moment. Joe and he, for some reason, had found me. I knew that there was an operational imperative that we probably needed to do something, because if we did get involved, there would probably be a civil war in Macedonia. But clearly, there was a huge humanitarian imperative. So literally, I'm talking about a three-minute telephone conversation out of the blue. If I let these people in, are you prepared? Can you guarantee that you can look after them? Well, I hadn't got a clue whether we could look after them or not. But I found myself just saying, yes, it'll be fine. Went back to brigade headquarters and said to the team, right, we're going to build and run refugee camps. We move on to the next slide. And there's a young-looking me. And the guy called Mark Malik Brown, who built and run refugee camps in Thailand. And I rang him. My wife's cousin and a great friend of the family. At one point was the Deputy Secretary General to the UN, to Kofi Annan, and very senior, was in the House of Lords and was a minister in Gordon Brown's government and one or two other things. But I rang Mark and I asked, got any advice? I'd never built refugee camps before. And we had a chat and I began to get a feel for what we were going to do. And then, next slide, we then built and ran refugee camps for about 60,000 people over several months. Where the kit came from, how we dealt with this, I honestly don't know. It was a moment that I am absolutely clear in my own mind, was a moment that as a result of having become a Christian, having made decisions in the previous years, having tried to do what I talked about earlier in terms of serving and all those other things, this was a very decisive moment for me. We built them for about 3 months, handed them over eventually to UN and NGOs, then went to Albania and built some camps in Albania, and then went into Kosovo and built some camps in Kosovo and got involved in rebuilding the infrastructure there, the railway lines, and various other bits and pieces. And I got a lot of flack over this. And for all of us, and storytelling, but you will all have been in situations where you need to make tough choices. And courageous choices. And not a lot of people agreed with me at this point. We were preparing to fight our way into Kosovo. 4 Armored Brigade, at the same time we were now bringing in 5 Airborne Brigade, run by a great mate of mine called Adrian Freer. And my brigade was involved in all of that and supporting that. I had people in Thessaloniki in Greece, I had people in Albania, I had people in Macedonia. It was chaos and uncertainty. And if I ever wrote a book, I think I would call it Comfortable with Chaos. Because as leaders, we have to make choices in very uncomfortable and chaotic conditions. But we have to make those choices. And they will sometimes, often actually, as leaders, be unpopular choices. And several people said to me, this is a big mistake. You are fixing your brigade, looking after this refugee problem, when we should be focusing on preparing to fight our way into Kosovo. To which my answer was, we're not going to fight our way into Kosovo unless we solve this problem. But even if that was not to be the case, this is the right thing to do, morally the right thing to do. And for about 48 hours, and I don't exaggerate at all, actually, for about 48 hours, I didn't know whether I was going to be sacked or not. Of course, when things work well, as somebody once said, success has many fathers, failure is an orphan. If this thing had gone badly wrong, I would have been the bloke carrying the candle. Because it was successful, all sorts of people then climb on the bandwagon, et cetera, et cetera. And I ended up by getting given a CBE. But it was a lonely place for quite a while, I can tell you. And the guy who made the big difference was Mike Jackson, who I'd worked for and knew very well, and Mike came in and supported me and so forth. But it was an important time. But I do think there are times, as a Christian, when we are called to do make certain decisions, and you know, we have to step up to the mark, really. If that makes sense.
Absolutely. I'm going to give you a few minutes rest, General Tim, because it's my turn to tell a story.
Go for it.
Okay, so earlier on, General Tim mentioned that... oh, no, literally only a minute. No, you're drafting.
I'm just getting my water. Just topping up the gin, that's all right.
General Tim mentioned his involvement in the planning for the war in Iraq. And 20 years ago exactly, I was also in the Army, and a newly promoted major working in the Army headquarters just outside Salisbury, where I was responsible for helping to plan the deployments of overseas operations. And we'd done Afghanistan the year before, and then this year was Iraq. And so we were heavily involved in all the planning. And I distinctly remember my bosses at the time telling me that they'd had a visit in the headquarters in Salisbury from a certain Major General Tim Cross, who had just come back from Washington, where he'd he'd gone over to meet the Americans who were working on the post-war planning. And I distinctly remember them telling me that he was really not impressed with what he'd found. Now, we didn't get to meet then, although General Tim had come to the headquarters, obviously because I was far too junior at this point. But it's a happy coincidence that here we are exactly 20 years later talking about it. So, General Tim, a lot has been said and written about the US and the coalition decision to invade Iraq in 2003, but in your view, what were the reasons behind the ultimate failure of the campaign?
Yeah, it was a fascinating time, and I think it's worth saying that, you know, when we talk about people like Tony Blair and others, we do need to see that in the context of what's been going on over quite a long period of time, why the certain decisions were taken. I wouldn't say I know Tony Blair well, but I briefed him and I had dinner with him several times and so forth, and you know, he had been deeply affected by Rwanda and indeed Kosovo. He'd been very much the lead in Kosovo. September the 11th had a huge impact, and people genuinely believed we needed to do something about Saddam Hussein. The ceasefire in 1991, I remember leaning on a Land Rover on the road from Kuwait City to Basra, not knowing at the time whether we were going to carry on after that 100-hour war in 1990. And the decision was eventually made that we were not going to carry on, which I think was the right decision at the time. But Saddam Hussein got a lot of his stuff, people away with quite a lot of equipment and so forth. And he stayed in power, of course, for another 12 years. And an awful lot of people died as a result of that. The Kurds got gassed, the Marsh Arabs got drained and all sorts of stuff. So I don't have a problem, and some of you may well have a problem, but I don't have a problem with the fact that the decision was made to do something about Saddam Hussein. And from a military point of view, the campaign planning was very good. I went to Washington. I was part of that campaign planning. I was appointed at what's called the Joint Force Logistic Component Commander for the British forces. We were going to go into northern Iraq at the time, and you know, all of that was going well. We, the UK, just made a decision to go through Kuwait in the south, and I was asked by Mike Jackson, who by then was the Chief of the General Staff, to go to Washington to look at this organization, which was called the Office of Post-War Planning, run by a guy called Jay Garner, retired US three-star, had been involved in northern Iraq after the first Gulf War, dealing with the refugees in the hills of northern Iraq, and had three commando brigade, the British commando brigade, under his command, what we call Operation Haven. And he was a great guy, a really nice guy, Jay. Anyway, Office of Post-War Planning, that had been established in January 2003, I know for a fact if Central Command in Florida had had their way, they would have invaded Iraq by then because people were wanting to get on with it. We in the UK didn't set up the equivalent of what we called the Iraq Planning Unit till February in the Foreign Office. And the Office of Post-War Planning was inside the Pentagon. So I went out there with my military assistant, who was a Lieutenant Commander, Royal Navy, Submariner, and he and I went off and, cut a long story short, got involved in this team in the Pentagon and tried to find out what was going on about post-war planning, as indeed did Jay Garner. And we had a whole series of meetings and sessions and so on. And anybody, to coin an American phrase, who had a dog in the fight would come to these things and talk about what they were trying to do and so forth. But the bottom line was there was really no coherent planning. And the American military were not interested. The American military had got a campaign plan to secure Baghdad, and then as far as they were concerned, they were going to go home and have the ticker tape parades that Schwarzkopf and others had had in 1991. get the medals, sell the books, you know, and get back to soldiering. So what happened after the war, they weren't really interested in. The guy who was really running this in America was Rumsfeld. So many of you will have heard of Rumsfeld. I think working primarily to Cheney, who was the vice president rather than President Bush. And I had lunch with Rumsfeld with about a half a dozen, eight senior American military in about February, March time. And they were talking about, you know, everything was ready, how was it going to go, and so on and so forth. And I was sitting quietly at the end of this table. And he eventually turned to me and said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, Mr. Secretary, I'm absolutely sure we'll win the military campaign." I said, "But what really worries me is we haven't really got a clarity of what the post-war situation is going to look like." And I said, "I think we need to involve the international community more. We need to involve the UN. We need to involve other people." But I said, "Primarily, the problem is that you are planning to reduce U.S. force levels to about 50,000 within 6 months. And the UK is planning to reduce to about 10,000 after 6 months." I said, "In Northern Ireland in the 1970s when I served, we had 28,000 British soldiers in Northern Ireland trying to keep the peace. Tiny province. In Kosovo, we had about 60,000 trying to look after the Kosovo problem. Again, a very small place. Iraq's the size of France. We were going in with about 200,000. I said, "And plan A may well be that everything goes brilliantly and we can reduce the force levels. But I don't think it's going to be that simple. I think we need a plan B and we need a plan C. We need to have, you know, other plans in place for post-war." Again, in leadership terms, and again, you know, we're all in leadership positions. We all have to make difficult choices. And I had no problem with the fact that people like Tony Blair and others had to make difficult choices. What was interesting about Rumsfeld was, if you didn't speak into his paradigm, he didn't want to know. And he just cut me out of the conversation completely. And leaders who lock themselves in their own paradigm and don't listen to the dissenting voices or the counter views and so forth, I think are doomed to failure eventually. And sadly, that's exactly what happened. There was no plan. And I'm not exaggerating when I say, and I gave evidence to the Chilcot inquiry on this, the plan was, we don't need a plan. The plan was, we will get rid of Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi people will stand up, give us a thunderous round of applause, become a democracy, we can go home and get on with the next part of this. And I exaggerate slightly for effect, but not by much. And of course, it went catastrophically wrong. And I lived in Baghdad subsequently for several months, watching this whole thing go pear-shaped. And I came back emotionally, physically, spiritually exhausted. But it did teach me a lesson, and I came back and had to think through failure and what did it mean for me. And we haven't got time to talk about failure in the round, but again, it's another talk that I do. But essentially, for when we fail, what happens inside us can range from what Judas did, which was to kill himself and commit suicide, to what others do, which is to blame everybody else, to what Pilate did, which is to wash his hands of the whole affair and hope to go away. Or we can begin to say to ourselves, I was part of that failure. I have to own my own responsibility and I have to learn from it and recognize actually that we all fail in some respects in our lives, maybe relationships, maybe our marriages, maybe with our children, with our work, with our whatever it is. This was obviously strategic failure. And I've looked back at it and think, did I brief the Prime Minister honestly? Was I strongly enough? I did brief him and say that I wasn't happy with the post-war plan, but was I strong enough about that? Was I strong enough with Rumsfeld? Was I strong enough when I briefed the Joint Chiefs and the Foreign Secretary and other people? Now, I was but a Major General, and there were lots of more senior people than me, but the reality was I was part of that failure. And, you know, the consequences have been pretty severe ever since. So I've had to learn from that. I've tried to learn from that. I've tried to recognize the reality of that and, you know, try to think about how I operate now and recognize that failure is something we all go through. We have to pick ourselves up and move on. How are we doing for time? We're all right. Am I going on? Am I banging on too much?
No. It's the last question, actually.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Last question for this part, anyway. So you've touched on various themes this evening, including the characteristics of courage and integrity. What can we learn from Jesus' example about those characteristics?
Yeah, well, in that period of time after I came back from the Garden Tomb, one of the things I found myself focusing in on was Christ. And I have to say, I'm a lay minister of the church, but I'm not a great fan of the church. I'm sorry, Vicar. I'm not a great fan of the church. I'm not a churchian. I'm a Christian. I follow Christ. And one of my mantras in life, now, some years ago, people talked about, I was listening to somebody talking about living a contented life. And people talk about happiness and all sorts of other stuff. But this particular speaker talked about living a contented life. And he said, to live a contented life, you need to have a deep sense of identity. Who am I? A real sense of purpose. What am I here for? And built on a strong sense of faith. Now, in that context, it wasn't a Christian talk, actually. So I happen to believe that everybody in this room is a person of faith. We all see the world through the prism of our beliefs. We all make our choices on the basis of those beliefs. And that may be humanist or atheist or agnostic or anything else. For those of us who are Christians, that prism is the prism of Christ. But that idea of a sense of identity and purpose and faith was part of, looking back, part of what I was seeing in Christ. Christ had a very clear sense of his identity. This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him, is what the Gospels tell us. He had a real sense of purpose. Why he had come. That purpose was to go to the cross. And of course he had a deep sense of faith. His relationship with his Father, with the good Lord, we know was obviously very, very powerful. And he was a man of enormous courage, both physical courage in the way that he had to put up with the fact that he was going to be crucified, but also moral courage. He was prepared to stand up to the authorities, to the religious leaders of his day. People tend to think about Jesus meek and mild, you know, this little baby in a stable and this Christmas story and all the rest of it. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. It's a load of rubbish. You read what Jesus has to say about some of these things, that you brood of vipers, and the way that he turns the tables over in the temple and so forth. He is no doormat. He's a strong, courageous, physically courageous, physically brave, and morally brave guy. And his purpose was not to sit alongside the rich and the powerful. I mean, he didn't exclude them at all. He dined with them and shared with them. But his real purpose was to look after the poor, the marginalized, the outcasts. And somebody once said to me, don't worry about people who earn more money than you do. Worry about people who earn less than you do. And it's a pretty good cry, actually. So when I looked at Jesus as a character, I saw a man of extraordinary courage, extraordinary bravery, extraordinary integrity, a determination to do what his purpose was, to live out his purpose, a really strong sense of identity, built on an absolute clarity of his faith. And I would, again, you know, challenge, ask the question of you all, who are you? Why are you here? Not here tonight. Why are you here on this earth? Because, sadly, we're all going to end up 6 foot under. In not that long, some of us probably, and a few years more for others. What do you want people to say about you? What is your identity? What are you rooted in? And I was reading a novel earlier on today, and it was talking about people at work getting up earlier than they would have wanted to, commuting on trains they didn't want to be on, working with people they didn't like much, doing a job that they could do without. And for most of us, that's how we go through our lives. We just, you know, that's what it is. And we get on with it, and we have to get on with it for all sorts of reasons. But that's not a good enough purpose in our lives. And having studied Christ at that time, I began to think much deeper about who am I and why am I here? Who am I serving? And I'm absolutely clear that when I kneel before the throne of grace, it won't have mattered a toss whether I was a private soldier or a major general or a president or a prime minister or a CEO or whatever of any organization. There'll be one question that I will be asked as I kneel before the throne of grace? What think ye of Christ? And it's a, you know, it's a very important question. And that's what my identity is rooted in. That's what my purpose is, to serve Christ as best I can, rooted in a deep faith that Christ rose from the dead the first Easter Sunday morning, and that changes everything. So I just followed him because I couldn't do anything else, really.